I'm Mark Strassman, producer and host of BookChat.org. We're in a dorm lounge at Occidental College in Eagle Rock, California, and we're about to speak to Hensi Goer, who's just written The Thinking Woman's Guide to a Better Birth. Welcome to BookChat.org.
I'm happy to be here. I guess I should say the reason we're in a dorm room is this is because this is where my daughter goes to school.
Well, we can say that. Why don't we sort of start right in the middle of the collection of constructs and ideas and positions that you have in A Thinking Woman's Guide to a Better Birth by asking what you recommend that women in labor have to eat and drink while they're having their children.
Well, that's perhaps a little more specific than I'd like to get. I think the major issue for women is that they know that, contrary to popular belief, there's no reason why they shouldn't be eating or drinking during labor. As to what they should eat and drink, the recommendation of midwives is that before labor, or in early part of labor, you want to make sure that you stay well hydrated, that you're getting plenty of clear liquids. You want to keep to things that you know that you digest easily and well, which means avoiding high-fat, spicy foods, things like that. Some people don't do well with dairy products. You don't want drinks that are acid, like orange juice and so on and so forth.
The idea, though, is that in all the countless, I have to say, I've never witnessed a birth live, and I guess I don't remember my own, but in the media and film and television and so on, one never sees women having anything to eat or drink, and in fact, their inability to eat or drink anything is often one of the most dramatic or difficult parts of the labor.
This is part of a larger problem in that in our culture, we define labor as being similar to a crisis preceding surgery, and so it ends up being treated as if, in fact, this was a surgical patient instead of the normal process that it should be.
In fact, that's kind of the key concept in A Thinking Woman's Guide to a Better Birth, isn't it?
Yes. The major issue is that, and this is the reason I wrote the book. I wrote the book because I was a Lamaze teacher, and I was realizing, I don't teach currently, I'm still a certified Lamaze teacher, but I was realizing that the people in my classes were being given all sorts of information by their caregivers, which in fact was not supported by the research. You can show that the consensus of the research does not support most of what the typical obstetrician does.
In fact, that in larger context is the theme of the book, of what you're trying to show, that obstetrical case management grows out of principles that are not necessarily, and in fact, as you make the case, are in many cases diametrically opposed to what the best medical research shows is really a better way to do a lot of things.
Yes. The buzzword in medicine these days is evidence-based care, meaning the practices are reflective of the best that we know about the research, and that is very patently not true in obstetrics. But the problem for women is they have no access to this. They're in the position of the people that they would go to get this information, their doctors, their anesthesiologists, the nurses, so on and so forth, are giving them things which in fact are not true, and they have no way no standard against which to measure that. What my book is a kind of consumer reports where you would have the option of going into the dealership and having the dealer tell you all our cars are wonderful and you can decide whether or not that's so. Or you can go to Consumer Reports and get information that will tell you, there's a lot going on in the background, bad luck.
Consumer Reports.
Yes.
Those dealerships.
That, this car has a very rough ride, and this car has a very poor repair record, and this one explodes on impact.
Well, in fact, it's kind of a non-trivial parallel between buying a car and having a child in a society in which both of those processes are dominated by men, and in which a lot of the consumption is done, in one case, all the consumption of the service, by women.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting to me is that cesarean section is the most common surgery in this country. Since 1983, one out of five women has been giving birth by major abdominal surgery. And at least half of those operations are unnecessary. And it is major abdominal surgery with the risks that that entails. But up until my book, I do two things in the book. One is I give women the research. So now they have a basis for making truly informed decisions, for avoiding unnecessary procedures, tests, drugs, and more importantly, for evaluating the quality of their care. And I give them, besides the research, lots of practical information, compare and contrast so that they can make decisions, lists of strategies to avoid unnecessary intervention. And at the end of the book, how to choose a caregiver and how to choose a place of birth.
Before we go into some more of the specific areas in which you weigh in with heavy amounts of concrete research versus the practices that are being used, I wanted to ask about your qualifications to make these comparisons, and I wanted to direct you, I guess, to another woman who you cite, Penny Simpkin, who was asked what her credentials were in her somewhat similar efforts, and tell us what she said and how you feel about that issue.
Oh, this is such a wonderful story. She is so widely respected, and she's so knowledgeable. And apparently, she put out an information sheet on the trade-offs of epidural anesthesia in a seminar that she gave, which the educators to whom she gave it subsequently were handing out copies of to their students. And this provoked the wrath of an anesthesiologist at a local hospital who called her on the carpet, and she first said, well, you know, is there anything wrong with what I said? Well, no, he said, but what are your credentials? And she said, you know, for once she came up with the answer instead of 3 hours later. She just looked at him and mildly replied, I can read. So can I. In order to get at the medical literature, all you need is, well, college-level reading skills, a medical dictionary until you learn the terminology, and a very basic understanding of the concepts, statistical concepts, so you know what they mean and you know how to evaluate an article or a study for its quality.
I'd also add that I think you need the ability to look beyond what passes for authorized, official, no longer, I suppose, godlike, but certainly very sanctioned conventional wisdom in the area. Wouldn't you say that, too?
I just picked up a wonderful quote today off a professor's door, and it was by Richard Feynman, and it is, science is the belief in the ignorance of experts.
By which you mean it's the facts, not the preconceived belief structures that make the difference.
Exactly. The reason why there's a gap between the research and practice is because the typical obstetrician practices according to what he or she thinks, believes, feels to be true, was told by the experts when he or she was in medical school and so on and so forth. And the problem with what you think, feel, and believe is that it isn't amenable to change by science, logic, or even common sense.
Well, it was my belief that the medical profession, like other scientific pursuits, works by trial and error and works by examining its own successes and failures and modifying its procedures accordingly. But you're making the argument here that at least obstetricians don't do that.
Exactly so. And that is why the gap has opened, because we're not talking here about one article saying this and another study saying that. We're talking about the consensus of the literature on pretty much every topic I wrote about in my book. Let me give you an example. Episiotomy. That's a snip to enlarge the vaginal opening for birth. There are no studies, period, that support any of the justifications that are given for the routine or frequent use of this practice. This is not new information. And as with any procedure, there are possible complications, some of them chronic and some of them serious. And yet, even though the episiotomy rate has been falling, nearly half of women who give birth vaginally are still having one.
Well, is obstetrics worse than other branches of the medical profession?
I'm not terrifically knowledgeable about other branches, but my feeling is that yes, it is. And I think the major reason for this is, at least in other branches of medicine, you don't go see a doctor unless you have a problem. whereas in obstetrics, you have surgical specialists in the pathology of women's reproductive organs caring for women who are, almost all of them, healthy women undergoing a natural process. But if you come from that background, you have certain beliefs about birth and what your proper role is and so on and so forth that can have a very negative effect on those women. Because the problem is, if you start treating people, well, every intervention has risks as well as benefits. So if you impose them on people who either don't have a problem or have one that could be solved by lesser means, for example, getting up and walking around instead of giving them a powerful drug to have stronger contractions, then you are exposing those women to the risks, but there are no benefits.
So what you're saying is that when people walk into a doctor's office in almost every case, there's something wrong with them that they want fixed, whereas in gynecology and obstetrics, a woman who becomes pregnant walks into a doctor's office. The doctor sees someone who needs to be fixed or medicalized or treated for a medical condition when pregnancy isn't really a medical condition. It's a natural bodily function.
Exactly. The midwifery model, on the other hand, and I will say that while you're more likely to find it with the midwife, there are some obstetricians who are excellent midwives as well as excellent obstetricians. The midwifery model works from the premise that birth is a natural and normal process. Yes, it needs a certain amount of observation. Yes, there can be problems and you want to watch out for them, but basically what women need is supportive care rather than interventive care. And as it turns out, which one matches the reality is the key. And again, there's a whole body of research that shows that you can achieve, that all of these interventions and precautions and so on don't achieve better outcomes, but do impose these risks. So the reality is that what midwives do as a class is superior care.
Say something about the historical context through which pregnancy became medicalized and moved into the hospital.
Well, it's actually a very sad story in the sense that in the 1800s in this country, especially towards the end of the 1800s, the doctors mounted a deliberate campaign to discredit midwives and succeeded in it. And this wasn't about midwives delivering inferior care. It was about economics, politics, and power.
Factors that I guess are still operating in this whole dynamic.
Oh, yes, very definitely. And because the Medical Association has tremendous power in what laws get passed. And I mean, one thing that's interesting to me is that the HMOs have not jumped at midwives because they deliver such cost-effective care. And I think, although this is not something I've researched, the reason why they haven't is because essentially you still have doctors in charge of who does what, when, and who gets paid for it.
That could end up with some complicated ironies. A big HMO here in California just announced that it was going to put the doctors in charge of deciding care a lot more than before without a lot of bureaucratic review, which could, from what you're saying, be worse from the point of view of women having children, babies, than the current situation.
Yes, because there are a lot of factors, and it's beyond the scope of this book or this interview to go into, but there are a lot of factors that determine what kind of care a doctor gives besides what's in the medical interests of the mother and the baby. Again, that's why I wrote the book, to give women access to some way of evaluating the quality of their care.
What about defensive medicine? Does that play a part in all of this?
Yes, it certainly does. And I have a tremendous issue. Whenever you raise the issue of defensive medicine, people defend it as, oh, well, what can you do? You know, we have people are so willing to sue in our society. But if you take a step back and you realize that the essential compact between a patient and a doctor is that that doctor is putting their knowledge and skills in the service of the patient, the moment you start talking defensive medicine, you are now talking about a doctor who is doing something that benefits the doctor, and that may be at the expense of the patient. We're not talking about different people disagreeing on what's best. We're talking about, I'm going to do this because it takes care of me. And what it does to you, oh well.
Well, doesn't that kind of directly contradict the Hippocratic injunction to first do no ill?
Yes, in a word. There is another principle, too, and that is that you do want to benefit the patient, and I can't remember the Latin for it at the moment.
I'm sure one of our listeners will call, will email in with it. So how would you separate the economic self-interests of the obstetric profession from gender bias, which is, I guess, a polite word for women hating?
Well, you know, I am aware that there are some obstetricians who actually are women haters, but I'm not that cynical. I really do believe that most obstetricians are out there doing what they think is best. The problem is that if you look at the research, it isn't necessarily best. But women, again, have no access to that.
What kind of scenario do you have in your own mind of the place you want your book to play in the empowerment of women in this process?
That's an interesting question. I guess what I would hope for is to give women the ability to choose quality care and to make choices, to recognize when they're in a situation which is not going to be the best for themselves or their babies. Hopefully to really start a new wave. I'd love to think I was personally responsible for bringing the cesarean rate down to a reasonable level. I know that in one case this book has already prevented one unnecessary cesarean.
Well, but more specifically, I guess, which is hard to be about something that's kind of a perspective, but do you envision, you know, having Oprah push the book and having millions of women read it and... I say that because she has a larger listening audience than I do, and have women form groups and then demand of their HMOs and of their obstetricians that they read the book and take account of this literature and change their procedures?
From your mouth to God's ears.
Okay, well, if he listens to the internet, I'm sure he'll be able to pick this up at bookchat.org. Thank you very much, Hensi Goer, for talking to us about The Thinking Woman's Guide to a Better Birth.
And thank you for having me.